UDEM Research, Kindergarten from First Principles, Episode 6.
Welcome back. Today we're tackling what might be the most important topic we've covered yet, a deep dive into the evidence, the real hard science behind early childhood education frameworks.
Right, because if you're a parent or an educator or even a policymaker, you're just swimming in this sea of different philosophies. You've got Montessori, Reggio Emilia, Waldorf.
High scope. And they all make these big claims. So what we're doing today is synthesizing decades of the most rigorous research out there. We're talking randomized controlled trials, longitudinal studies.
The goal is to cut right through the philosophy and get to what the science actually says works.
Exactly. We're moving past the marketing brochures and into the quantifiable data.
Which is so critical because the choices we make when kids are between, say, 3 and 5 years old have this profound impact on their cognitive and social development down the line. We need to know where to put our focus, our time, and our money.
And, you know, we should just deliver the core insight right at the top.
Let's do it.
After digging into all of this research, studying every major framework, the answer is actually, it's pretty clarifying.
Yeah.
It turns out that implementation fidelity matters so much more than the philosophical purity or the label on the school's front door.
So how well you do it is more important than what you call it.
Infinitely more important. The name can mean very little if the actual underlying method is diluted. We found that, frankly, a lot of popular practices have almost no empirical support, while some things that get dismissed are actually strongly validated by science.
So that's our mission for you, the listener, today. We're going to identify what developmental science really supports, what's just, you know, a philosophical preference.
And most importantly, how you can actually spot high-quality early childhood education. We'll give you the measurable data, the specific effect sizes, the frameworks that are backed by research so you can make a decision that's rooted in evidence, not just in good marketing.
Okay, so let's start with the approach that seems to have the strongest, most consistent evidence base behind it, Montessori. This all started with Maria Montessori, who was, amazingly, one of Italy's first female physicians. She opened her first school, the Casa dei Bambini, or Children's House, way back in 1907.
And the context here is just so important. She opened it in San Lorenzo, which was a really disadvantaged slum district in Rome.
So she wasn't working with privileged children.
Not at all. And she didn't start with some grand theory of what children should be doing. She was just an observer. Her job was to supervise the children of working parents, many of whom had little education themselves. And what she saw was this. She called it an astonishing, almost effortless ability to learn that happened when kids were just allowed to interact with their environment in a self-directed way.
In all her core principles, the mixed-stage classrooms, those famous long, uninterrupted work periods, the self-correcting materials, they all came from that initial observation.
That's right. The teacher acts as a quiet observer, a guide, not a lecturer. It was all derived from scientific observation in a real-world setting, which is why it lends itself so well to being tested.
And unlike some other frameworks that kind of resist being measured, Montessori has been put through the ringer for decades. So what does the latest, most comprehensive science say?
The evidence is, frankly, remarkably robust. But, and this is the key, only when the fidelity is high.
When it's done right.
When it's done right. To get the big picture, we can look at the gold standard of evidence synthesis, which is the 2023 Campbell Systematic Review.
Okay.
This review, led by Randolph and his colleagues, basically pulled together the results from 32 different studies. It's a massive data set, over 132,000 data points, and it confirmed consistent positive effects across the board for both cognitive and non-cognitive skills.
Let's get into the specific numbers, because that's where the truth really is. When you compare a high-fidelity Montessori program to a conventional school, what do the effect sizes look like?
They're substantial. For general academic outcomes, the effect size was 0.26. For mathematics, it was 0.22. And both of those are based on what the review calls high-quality evidence.
And what about for executive function? That seems to be the holy grail in early childhood.
It really is. And for executive function, let's just quickly define that for everyone.
Yes.
We're talking about those crucial skills like inhibitory control, you know, not blurting things out, the ability to switch tasks, and your working memory, your brain's CEO, basically.
Right.
For that, the effect size jumped to 0.36. The evidence quality was rated as moderate, but the number is huge.
Now, a number like 0.26 or 0.36, It can sound a bit abstract or technical, so can you define that key term for us? What exactly is an effect size, and how should we think about those numbers?
That's the most important question. So an effect size just measures the magnitude of the difference between two groups. In this case, it's the Montessori kids versus the kids in conventional schools. A small effect might be around 0.10. A very large effect is usually up around 0.80.
So in the messy real world of education research, how good is a 0.20 or a 0.30?
It's actually huge. There's a 2020 analysis from an educational researcher, Matthew Kraft, that is key here. He argues that in field-based educational research, where you can't control every single variable, any effect that's over 0.20 should be considered large.
Really? That's the threshold for large?
Yes. For context, some of the most highly regarded super intensive interventions we have, things like high dosage tutoring or the big name high performing charter school models, they often report effect sizes in that same 0.0 to 0.40 range.
So when we see 0.26 for academics and 0.36 for executive function, that's a really big deal.
It's a very big deal. It confirms that authentic Montessori is delivering outcomes that are comparable to some of the strongest and, frankly, most expensive educational interventions out there.
But there's always that classic problem in ECE research, selection bias. The parents who choose Montessori might just be more engaged or educated to begin with.
Exactly. Which is why researchers turn to the gold standard to eliminate that problem.
Yeah.
Using lottery data.
The randomized control trial.
The Holy Grail. Angeline Lillard's 2006 Milwaukee study, which was published in the journal Science, is the perfect example. They compared kids who won a lottery spot in a public Montessori program to the kids who applied but lost the lottery and went to other schools.
So both groups of parents were equally motivated. They all wanted Montessori.
Precisely. And the lottery winners showed superior letter word identification, better math skills, stronger executive function, and even better social understanding. It controlled for that parent motivation factor perfectly.
And one of the most remarkable things is that these effects seem to last. They don't just fade out by third grade, which is what happens with so many other early interventions.
That is the critical distinction. A 2017 longitudinal study out of Hartford tracked 141 kids and found accelerating growth over time in the Montessori group.
Accelerating. So the gap actually gets wider.
Yes. The gap widens over time, which strongly suggests that the benefits are cumulative. It's not just a temporary academic boost from memorization. The method seems to be building these foundational cognitive structures, like self-regulation and deep conceptual understanding, that pay bigger and bigger dividends as school gets harder.
And this research base just keeps getting stronger, right? There was a more recent large-scale study.
A huge one. A 2025 National Randomized Controlled Trial, an RCT, published in PNAS, that's the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they just confirmed all of this again. They found effects over 0.20 across 24 different public programs for reading, executive function, short-term memory. The list goes on.
So the science is basically settled for the authentic method.
Yes. For the authentic method. But this is where we run smack into the painful reality, what you could call the fidelity catastrophe.
Okay, let's break that down. When we say Montessori, that word itself has, well, it's been diluted.
It's been completely hijacked. And here's why. Montessori is not a trademarked name.
Oh, I had no idea.
Most people don't. So literally any daycare or preschool can just slap the name on their sign. And they do. There are over 4,000 schools in the U.S. that use the name Montessori.
But how many of them are actually doing it correctly? The numbers on this are just shocking.
They're staggering. Of those 4,000 plus schools, only about 12,250 are affiliated with the American Montessori Society, or AMS.
Which is one of the main accrediting bodies.
Right. But if you look at the organization Maria Montessori founded herself, the one with the absolute highest standards for rigor, the Association Montessori Internationale, or AMI, only about 220 schools are recognized by them.
220 out of 4,000.
That's just 5%. 5% of schools calling themselves Montessori are operating with the highest, most rigorously demonstrated level of fidelity.
And the research is clear that this dilution absolutely kills the positive outcomes. I'm thinking of Lillard's 2012 fidelity study. That one really shines a light on why this matters so much.
It's the most illuminating study on this. Lillard compared what she called high-fidelity classrooms. So, places using 95 to 100% of the core prescribed Montessori materials with supplemented classrooms.
And what did supplemented mean?
It meant they were only using about 38 to 56% of the core materials, and they were mixing them in with, generic commercial puzzles, worksheets, things like that.
And the results?
Unsurprisingly, the high-fidelity classrooms produced much greater gains across every single outcome they measured. But here's the kicker. This is the part of the study that really shows you the mechanism.
What happened during the intervention phase?
They went into those supplemented classrooms and they just took out the non-Montessori stuff. They removed the commercial puzzles. They got rid of the worksheets. And what happened?
The kids did better.
The children subsequently showed significantly greater advancements in their early reading and executive function skills. That's the crucial finding. It shows that the core, specialized, self-correcting design of the authentic materials is the engine. When you dilute it with generic stuff, you're not adding to it. You're actively compromising the entire system.
So let's make this really practical. If you're a listener evaluating a program that calls itself Montessori, what are the big red flags, the warning signs of low fidelity that kill the efficacy?
The research points to five really serious flaws to watch out for. First, mixed-age classrooms. The standard is 3 to 6-year-olds together. If they're separating by age, that's a huge deviation.
Okay, what's second?
Minimal teacher training. Full AMI certification takes over 1,200 hours of specialized training. If a teacher just did a quick 6-week online course, that's totally inadequate. Interruption of the work block. That 2.5 to 3-hour uninterrupted work cycle is sacred. If they're constantly breaking it up for specials like music or Spanish, they're breaking the core mechanism that allows for deep concentration.
What else?
Fourth is the addition of non-Montessori materials. We just talked about this. If you see worksheets, plastic toys, commercial manipulatives everywhere, that's a bad sign. And fifth, conflicting standardized testing requirements. If the school is forced to teach to the test, it pushes the teacher toward extrinsic rewards, which is the exact opposite of the philosophy's focus on intrinsic motivation.
The lesson here is just brutally clear. You can't just buy the name Montessori. You have to buy into the rigorous, undiluted execution of the method to get the benefits.
That's exactly right.
All right, let's move on to a framework that produced maybe the most important evidence for policymakers in the 20th century. I'm talking about the High Scope Perry Preschool Project.
Ah, yes. The study that is always cited for its incredible economic return on investment.
For good reason.
The Perry Preschool Project, which ran from 1962 to 1967, is really the absolute gold standard of longitudinal research. It was led by David Weikart in Ypsilanti, Michigan, with 123 severely disadvantaged African-American children.
And we really need to stress the intensity of this program. This was not your average scalable preschool.
Oh, absolutely not. This was a demonstration project, meaning it was designed to show the maximum possible impact. The kids had an incredible 4-to-1 child-teacher ratio.
4-to-1.
And all the teachers were certified and had bachelor's degrees. But the really unique, crucial piece that so often gets forgotten in policy debates was the weekly 90-minute home visits.
And these were done by the same teachers from the classroom.
Yes. And these weren't just quick check-ins. They were establishing a true partnership with the parents. They were modeling instructional techniques, showing parents how to engage with their kids in cognitively stimulating ways. It was a comprehensive 2-generation support system.
And the follow-up studies, which tracked these individuals all the way to age 27, then age 40, they provided undeniable proof that this intensity had these lasting, powerful benefits.
The benefits were stunning. The participants had much higher high school graduation rates, better employment, higher earnings, and this is the big one for the economic case.
Yeah.
Dramatically reduced lifetime involvement with the criminal justice system. Lower arrest rates, less time incarcerated.
This is the study that the Nobel laureate James Heckman loves to talk about. His analysis basically puts this kind of intervention on par with major infrastructure spending.
It really does. Heckman's team calculated a social rate of return of 7% to 10% per year.
Which is just a phenomenal return.
It's incredible. Most safe investments give you a fraction of that. And the cost-benefit ratio was calculated to be between $7 and $12 return for every single dollar invested.
Wow. And where did most of that return come from? Was it from the higher earnings?
No, and that's the fascinating part. The biggest chunk of the savings came from preventing social costs. Crime reduction alone accounted for about 65% of the total economic return.
So it's cheaper to invest in high-quality ECE than it is to pay for remediation, social services, and incarceration later on.
By a huge margin. And even more amazing, the 50-year follow-up data showed intergenerational effects. The children of the original participants were more likely to finish high school themselves. It suggests that a single high-quality intervention can actually break a cycle of disadvantage.
These findings are famous. They're everywhere. But we have to be really clear about why this famous study does not automatically validate the modern, scaled-up versions of the HyScope curriculum that are used today.
This is the crucial context that always gets missed. There are three non-negotiable caveats here. First, Perry Preschool was a high-intensity demonstration project. Almost no modern HyScope program, like the ones used in Head Start all over the country, can match that 4-to-1 ratio or those weekly 90-minute home visits. When you scale a program up, you almost always lose intensity. And the intensity was clearly key here.
Okay, that's caveat number one. What's number two?
You have to look at the control group. Who were they being compared to?
They were being compared to kids who got nothing.
Exactly. The control group received no preschool at all, which was pretty standard for poor kids in the 1960s. Today, over 70% of four-year-olds are in some kind of preschool. So the Perry data proves that an intensive program is better than total neglect. It doesn't tell us how a modern, scaled-up HyScope program compares to, say, a modern, conventional preschool. The baseline has completely changed.
And the third point comes from the federal government's own watchdog on educational evidence, the What Works Clearinghouse.
Right, the WWC. They are incredibly rigorous, and they found no studies of the modern HyScope curriculum that meet their evidence standards.
Zero.
Zero. Their conclusion is blunt. They say they are unable to draw any research-based conclusions about its effectiveness today. So the lesson from Perry is that high-intensity, high-quality intervention pays off massively. But that does not mean the specific HyScope curriculum as it's being used today is what's driving that effect.
That's a really critical distinction. This brings us to a story that serves as a huge cautionary tale in ECE research. The story of the Tools of the Mind curriculum.
Oh, this is such an important case study in the need for rigor and replication.
It started out as this incredibly promising approach because it was designed to explicitly target executive function.
Right. Tools of the Mind is based on Vygotskian theory, which is all about how social interaction and language build up a child's cognitive abilities. The curriculum uses things like mature dramatic play and play planning, where kids have to draw or write out a plan before they act it out, all to build those EF skills.
And it got a ton of attention after a 2007 study was published in Science Magazine, of all places.
That's right, a study by Adele Diamond. And that initial small study showed that the Tools of the Mind students were significantly outperforming the control group on these computerized executive function tasks. This created a huge buzz.
Because EF skills are so predictive of later success.
Highly predictive. We see a strong correlation between early EF and later math ability, for example. So everyone got very excited.
But that initial study, even though it was in a top journal, had some serious flaws.
It had some classic methodological red flags. It was a very small sample size. And critically, there was no pretest data.
So they didn't have a baseline.
Exactly. Without a baseline, you can't be sure the two groups of kids were actually equivalent to begin with. It leaves the door wide open for selection bias to skew the results.
So the definitive test had to come from a much larger, more rigorous replication study.
And it did. The Institute of Education Sciences, the IES, which is the research arm of the Department of Education, funded a massive replication. It was run by Dale Farron and her team at Vanderbilt.
And this was the gold standard in terms of design.
Absolutely. A cluster randomized controlled trial with 60 schools, 877 children. And to make sure it was done right, the curriculum developers themselves provided all the training to the teachers. So fidelity should have been at its peak.
So best possible design, developer-led training. What happened? What were the results?
A complete and total collapse of the effects. It was devastating for the program.
No effects at all.
They found no positive treatment effects on academic outcomes,
right.
No positive effects on executive function, and no positive effects on self-regulation. In fact, in some of the follow-up measures, they even saw some possible negative effects.
Wait, how is that even possible? If the developers themselves did the training and the design was a gold standard RCT, how does a program that seemed to work so well in a small trial just completely fail at scale?
That is the million-dollar question in what's called implementation science. One of the leading theories is the difference between an efficacy trial, that's the small initial study under perfect conditions, and an effectiveness trial, which is the large real-world replication.
So what works in a lab doesn't always work in the real world.
Exactly. The sheer complexity and effort needed to maintain high fidelity for a really complex curriculum like Tools of the Mind across dozens of different schools with different teachers and different kids. It may just be impossible in a real-world setting. What worked for a handful of hand-picked, highly motivated classrooms just broke apart under the strain of a typical public school implementation.
So the final verdict from the What Works Clearinghouse was pretty damning.
Brutal. They concluded that Tools of the Mind has no discernible effects on any key domain. The lesson for everyone, parents, school leaders, policymakers, is that you have to be so careful. Early, promising results, even from a top journal, have to survive large-scale replication before we bet the farm on them.
Enthusiasm has to be tempered by that replication dust.
It's non-negotiable.
Okay, let's shift gears now and talk about frameworks that are maybe more philosophical, that often intentionally resist the kind of quantitative measurement we've been discussing. Let's start with Reggio Emilia.
Reggio Emilia is an incredibly influential and, frankly, beautiful philosophy. And it literally rose from the rubble of World War II Italy. Parents in the Emilia-Romagna region rebuilt their own schools as this grassroots community effort.
And the philosophy itself was developed by Loris Malagusi.
Yes, and it's centered on this amazing concept of the child's 100 languages, the idea that children have all these multiple ways of expressing their understanding through painting, sculpture, music, drama.
So what does that actually look like in a classroom? What are the core practices?
It's all about process and documentation. They use what's called an emergent curriculum, which means the projects grow organically from the children's own shared interests, not from a preset lesson plan.
So it's very child-led.
Very. They also use extensive documentation, so lots of photos, transcripts of conversations, portfolios of work, to make the children's learning process visible to everyone. Every school has an atelierista, a full-time art specialist. And the environment itself is considered the third teacher, designed to be beautiful and to provoke curiosity.
It sounds amazing. But when you start looking for the hard data, the empirical outcomes, comparing it to other high-quality programs, the picture gets a little fuzzy.
It gets very muddy, especially on measurable academic gains. The most rigorous study we have is from James Heckman in 2017. He tracked adults who had attended these municipal preschools in Reggio Emilia.
And what did he find?
The findings were mixed. When he compared the Reggio group to a control group that had no childcare at all, he found significant positive effects later in life on things like employment and social skills.
But that's the same comparison as the Perry preschool study, something versus nothing. What happened when he compared them to other available childcare programs in Italy?
That's the key question. And when he did that comparison, his team found few statistically significant effects.
So it wasn't demonstrably better than other good preschools?
Right. And Heckman's team had a theory, the diffusion hypothesis, which was basically that over the decades, the best parts of Reggio, the beautiful environments, the project-based work, had just been adopted by lots of other Italian preschools. So it kind of lost its unique comparative advantage.
And if you're a researcher looking for that quantitative proof, you're not going to find much.
You're not. A big 2019 literature review looked at all the available research and concluded, very bluntly, the lack of outcome research to support the efficacy of the implementation of Reggio-inspired practices.
And it's important to note, for Reggio proponents, this isn't necessarily a failure. It's a philosophical choice.
It is. Many Reggio advocates will state very clearly that the approach actively resists outcomes, measurement, and accountability, as defined by standardized tests. They feel that kind of quantitative measurement just fundamentally misunderstands and cheapens the richness of the learning process.
So it's a profound philosophy, but the claims of superior measurable outcomes just aren't backed by rigorous comparative evidence.
That's a fair summary.
Okay, let's talk about the youngest children, infants and toddlers. There's a specific philosophy for them called RIE, and let me spell that out. It's Resources for Infant Educators.
Right, co-founded by Magda Gerber, and it's based on the work of a Hungarian pediatrician, Emmy Pickler. This is all about the birth to three age range.
And what's the core principle?
The core principle is profound. It's respect for the infant's competence. The whole approach rejects the idea that you have to teach babies skills. Instead, the focus is on providing an environment for uninterrupted play and treating caregiving routines, diapering, feeding, bathing as opportunities for deep, intentional connection, not as chores to be rushed.
And the most distinctive part of RE, the part that really goes against the grain of modern parenting, is the approach to motor development.
Yes, the principle of freedom of movement.
The idea?
The idea is simple but radical. You never place a baby in a position that they cannot get into by themselves.
So no propping them up to sit before they can sit on their own?
No propping them up to sit. No forced tummy time. And crucially, no devices like baby walkers, jumpers, or bouncers that put the baby in an artificial position. The philosophy is that the body's own initiation of movement is essential for healthy neurological development.
And the observational research for this comes from a pretty remarkable place, the Pichler Institute.
A remarkable and tragic place. The Pichler Institute in Budapest was an orphanage that operated for over 60 years, caring for more than 2,000 infants who had lost their parents, many in the Holocaust.
Wow.
And their detailed observations found two incredible things. First, when babies are given total freedom of movement, they universally learn to creep or crawl before they learn to sit. And second, the children raised in this orphanage, despite being in an institution, showed no signs of the typical institutionalization damage. They grew up to be well-adjusted adults.
Which is an incredible finding. Institutional care almost always leads to long-term harm.
It's a profound testament to the power of her approach. But we have to note the research limitations.
Right.
The independent validation is limited. Most of the evidence is observational and comes from the institute itself. We don't have large-scale, rigorous, comparative trials of the full R.E. Pichler framework against other infant care models.
So the principles are ethically sound and developmentally plausible, but the direct comparative evidence base isn't there yet.
Precisely. Okay, our third major philosophical framework is Waldorf education, founded by Rudolf Steiner in 1919. And to understand Waldorf, you have to understand its foundation, which is anthroposophy.
And that is what exactly?
It's a complex, some would say esoteric, spiritual worldview.
Yeah.
It involves concepts like karma, reincarnation, and these very distinct stages of child development that are linked to spiritual evolution. And that philosophy informs everything they do.
And the most controversial part of the Waldorf approach, especially in early childhood, is its strict adherence to developmental staging. They delay formal academics longer than almost anyone else.
They do. The philosophy says that early childhood, so from birth to age 7, should be focused entirely on imaginative play, imitations, storytelling, and rich sensory experiences. They believe the child's physical and emotional body has to be ready first.
So that means no formal academics, no letters, no numbers, no reading instruction.
Nothing. Formal reading instruction doesn't begin until the child is around 7 years old when they enter first grade.
And here's where the evidence gets so interesting and counterintuitive. That very idea-resisting premature academics is the one element of the Waldorf philosophy that actually has strong empirical support.
It's one of the most fascinating findings in this whole deep dive. A researcher named Sebastian Suggate has done extensive work challenging this earlier is better assumption about reading. He reanalyzed the International PISA data,
which tests 15-year-olds all over the world.
Exactly. He looked at data from 54 countries and found that the age a child started school had no significant relationship with their reading achievement at age 15.
So starting at 5 versus starting at 7 made no difference a decade later.
No lasting advantage. And his own longitudinal study in New Zealand was even more compelling. He compared kids who started reading instruction at age 5 with kids who started at age 7.
And what did he find?
He found that while the early starters were ahead at first, that difference in reading fluency completely disappeared by age 11. But here's the critical part. The kids who started later, at age 7, actually showed greater reading comprehension at age 11.
Better comprehension? Why would that be?
The theory is that those kids had 2 extra years to focus on oral language, on building vocabulary, on having the kinds of rich sensory experiences that Waldorf prioritizes. Reading comprehension isn't just about decoding letters. It's about having the background knowledge and vocabulary to understand what you're reading. Suggate's work really supports the Waldorf timing.
So that one core principle is scientifically defensible. But when you look at the broader academic picture or some of the community factors, the evidence is weaker.
It is. A 2021 Austrian study found that while Waldorf students reported higher enjoyment and interest in learning science.
So they liked it more.
They liked it more, but they showed lower science achievement on standardized tests compared to a matched control group. So there seems to be a trade-off there, at least in the short term.
And then there are the public health concerns, which are linked to the philosophical underpinnings of the community. This is a big one.
It's a critical factor any parent has to consider. A 2023 systematic review documented 18 separate measles outbreaks between 1997 and 2011 that were linked to anthroposophic communities in Europe. 8 of those outbreaks started at Waldorf schools.
And that's because of low vaccination rates.
Extremely low. The review found some Waldorf schools with vaccination exemption rates higher than 79%.
Wow. And is that rooted in the anthroposophy philosophy itself?
It is. It connects to the broader anthroposophic medical tradition, which often favors alternatives to mainstream medicine, and has certain beliefs about illness being a necessary part of spiritual development. Mainstream medicine generally views these approaches as pseudoscientific. So while the school itself may not have a policy against vaccination, the community that's drawn to the philosophy often creates these pockets of very low herd immunity, which is a significant public health risk.
Okay, we've talked a lot about philosophy. Let's get back to the measurable physical world. All of these frameworks, Montessori, Reggio, Waldorf, they all value the environment. They call it the third teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But that's often used to justify these very specific aesthetic choices. You know, lots of natural wood, muted colors that don't always have an empirical basis. So which specific design elements actually have measurable scientific support?
This is where we can move from philosophy to hard data. And the strongest, most counterintuitive finding is about visual complexity, or as most of us would call it, visual clutter.
This is the research from Anna Fisher at Carnegie Mellon. It basically challenged the entire look of the typical, highly decorated American kindergarten classroom.
Her 2014 study was a bombshell. She found that kindergartners in these highly decorated classrooms were off task an incredible 39% of the time.
A third of the time, they're not even paying attention.
Right, compared to only 28% of the time in a sparse, decluttered classroom. And the difference in actual learning was dramatic. Over just a two-week period, the kids in the decorated room showed learning gains of only 18% versus 33% in the sparse room.
So you get almost double the learning just by taking stuff off the walls.
And their accuracy on tests reflected that. 42% correct in the decorated room versus 55% correct in the sparse one. It's a 15 percentage point learning gain.
What's the mechanism there? Why is clutter so bad for learning?
It comes right back to executive function. A young child's brain just isn't mature enough to filter out all that irrelevant visual information. Every colorful poster, every chart, every piece of art is competing for their limited attention. It increases their cognitive load and just pulls them off task. For learning, less is absolutely more.
Okay, so beyond just clutter, is there a broader framework for thinking about classroom design?
There is. The University of Salford in the UK did the definitive study called the HEAD study. That's Holistic Evidence in Design. They looked at everything.
And what did they find?
They studied over 3,700 students and found that the physical design of the classroom accounts for a massive 16% of the variation in learning progress over a single year. That's a huge effect for a passive intervention.
16%. And they boiled it down into a simple framework, right?
Yes, the SIN framework, which is easy to remember. SIN.
S for stimulation, I for individuality, and N for naturalness.
Exactly. And they found a clear hierarchy. Naturalness, things like light, air quality, temperature, that accounted for about 50% of the total impact. The other two, individuality and stimulation, were about 25% each. So we're going to focus on one thing. Focus on naturalness.
And natural light specifically seems to be a huge driver of outcomes.
A non-negotiable factor. A huge study of 21,000 students found that the kids with the most daylight exposure in their classrooms had 26% higher reading outcomes and 20% higher math outcomes.
Incredible. What about noise? That's just a constant in most early childhood settings.
And it's a huge cognitive drain. A meta-analysis found a big negative effect size of -0.46 for chronic noise on performance. And speech noise, like other people talking, is particularly bad for kids' comprehension because their brain is working overtime just trying to filter it out.
Let's talk about the paradox of choice when it comes to toys and materials. We all assume that more is better.
And that assumption is completely wrong. A 2018 study found that toddlers who were given only 4 toys played for longer and showed more creativity and imagination than toddlers who were given 16 toys.
So 4 is better than 16.
Much better. The effect sizes were medium to large. And to put that in context, the average American home has about 90 toys per child.
90.
We are systematically overwhelming our kids with choices, which leads to less focus and shallower play. The evidence is clear. Limit the quantity to maybe 4 to 10 items and rotate them to keep things fresh.
And what about the types of toys? Blocks and puzzles seem to have a special status.
They do, and it's well deserved. There's a robust link between playing with blocks and puzzles and developing spatial reasoning skills, which in turn is highly correlated with later math ability.
And the mechanism there is language, right?
It's all about the language. When parents or teachers engage in guided block play, they use more spatial language words like under, next to, taller, corner. And that language is what directly predicts the child's spatial skill development.
But what about the material of the toys? There's a huge preference in Waldorf and Reggio for natural materials, for wood over plastic. Is there cognitive data to back that up?
This is where we have to be really honest about the evidence. The preference for wood over plastic is almost entirely philosophical and aesthetic.
So there's no study showing kids learn better from wooden blocks?
No. There are no robust experimental studies that directly compare cognitive outcomes from playing with wooden versus plastic toys. Now, natural materials have wonderful sensory properties, and there are valid concerns about chemicals and plastics. But the cognitive benefit comes from the type of play, the constructive, spatial play, not the material itself.
That's a crucial distinction. Okay, let's bring this all together. We need to circle back to this central theme that's emerged. Implementation quality matters more than the curriculum's brand name.
It's the overwhelming conclusion from the research community. The label on the box is becoming increasingly meaningless without proof of high-fidelity execution.
And there's a huge federal study that confirms this, right? The Preschool Curriculum Evaluation Research Study.
Yes, the PCER study.
Mm-hmm.
And the findings were sobering, to say the least, for the curriculum industry. They evaluated 14 popular, widely used curricula with rigorous experimental designs.
And what did they find?
They found that 10 of the 14 curricula showed no statistically significant impacts on student outcomes when compared to the control group, which was just business as usual.
So in the vast majority of cases, buying and implementing a fancy, expensive curriculum was no better than just doing what preschools were already doing.
Exactly. The real irony is that the most popular programs often have the weakest evidence. The two most commonly used curricula in the U.S., Creative Curriculum and HiSCOPE, have the absolute weakest evidence bases, according to the What Works Clearinghouse. So there's this huge disconnect between what's popular and what's actually proven to work.
Let's talk about some of the big mistakes that lead to this, a critical failure mode, where a good idea, like following the child, can turn into something ineffective.
Right, the failure mode, where child-led becomes neglect, where the adult just becomes a passive observer instead of a strategic guide.
And the research is clear that autonomy and structure are not opposites.
They have to work together. The National Association for the Education of Young Children, NAEYC, their position is that clear rules and structure actually support a child's autonomy by giving them a safe and predictable framework to explore within.
And the data is clear that the adult has to be an active participant.
Absolutely. One study found that parental scaffolding at age 3 had a direct, measurable effect on a child's executive function at age 4. If the adult isn't there to strategically extend the child's thinking, to offer the right language at the right moment, that crucial learning opportunity is just lost.
Another big mistake in the modern world is the reliance on educational apps and products.
Oh, it's a minefield. Analyses of the top downloaded kids' apps find they're just loaded with advertising and distracting animations. And the real irony is that the apps that have genuinely higher educational value are consistently rated as less appealing to children, and they get played less often.
So kids prefer the flashy junk.
They do,
yeah.
Which often leads to a lot of wasted screen time.
Speaking of screen time, there's a surprising finding about what it displaces. We all worry that it's displacing reading time with parents.
And that worry seems to be largely unfounded. A 2022 study in Nature Pediatric Research found that screen time did not seem to displace parental reading time. That seems to be a protected, high-priority routine in most families.
But it did displace something else that was crucial.
It did displace peer playtime. And that displacement was directly linked to developmental delays. So the real risk of screen time isn't lost reading. It's the lost opportunities for social interaction, for negotiation, for problem solving with other kids.
So after all of this, stripping away the weak evidence, focusing on what works, what are the high confidence recommendations? What should every high quality program be doing?
We can confidently say a few things. First, in the environment. Use the SIN framework.
Mm-hmm.
Reduce visual clutter. That's a 15-point learning gain right there. Maximize natural light. And minimize noise. Materials. Provide spatial toys like blocks and puzzles. And drastically limit the quantity of toys to maybe 4 to 10 at a time and rotate them.
And third, what seems to be the most important factor of all?
Adult quality. This is everything.
Yeah.
You have to prioritize the quality of teacher-child interactions, specifically what's called instructional support scaffolding, asking open-ended questions, extending a child's thinking.
And we can measure that, right?
We can. The class assessment tool is the gold standard, and it shows that instructional support is both the weakest area in typical preschools and the single strongest predictor of positive long-term outcomes.
And finally, the support structure around the teacher.
Right. You need ongoing coaching and professional development to make these changes stick. and you have to engage parents as true partners in their child's education.
Okay, so let's synthesize across all these different frameworks. Despite all the philosophical battles, when you look at high-fidelity Montessori, Reggio, and Waldorf programs, there are some universal principles where they all converge.
They really do. There are four big ones. One, respect for the child's competence and agency. They all see the child as an active builder of knowledge, not an empty bucket to be filled.
Two.
Play is the primary medium of learning. Whether it's Montessori work or Reggio projects, it's all based on active, self-directed engagement.
Three.
Intentional adult presence. Child-led never means adult absent. The adult is always observing, planning, and strategically intervening. And four, a resistance to premature academics, which, as we saw, is actually backed up by the research on reading.
But the hard evidence adds some critical differentiators. If you had to boil down the final research verdict into three key points, what would they be?
Okay, 3 points. First, fidelity trumps the philosophical label. The name Montessori is worthless. The rigorous application of the system is everything.
Second,
structured, targeted curricula are necessary for specific, measurable policy outcomes. The huge economic benefits of Perry Preschool came from a very intentional, structured intervention.
And third, and most important,
the quality of the teacher-child interaction predicts outcomes more reliably than the name of the curriculum. The PCER study showed most curricula don't really matter, but the quality of the adult guiding the child always matters.
And as rigorous researchers, we have to admit what we still don't know. What are the big, honest uncertainties that remain?
There are a few big ones. First is the package problem. For a method like Montessori, we don't know which specific piece, the mixed-age class, the materials, the work period, is driving the effect. It's a complex package that's hard to test in pieces.
We also lack long-term data for typical kids.
Right. We don't know for sure if these benefits persist into adulthood for a typical middle-class population, the way they did for the very specific Perry Preschool group, and the spectacular replication failure of Tools of the Mind. We still don't have a great explanation for that.
And the most troubling question of all, coming from that PCER study, does the curriculum even matter that much?
It's the elephant in the room. If 10 out of 14 popular curricula show no effects, we have to consider the possibility that it's not about the book on the shelf. It might just be that the quality of the adult's interaction with the child trumps whatever philosophical guide they're supposed to be using.
So let's wrap this all up into a practical, actionable checklist.
Yeah.
For a listener who is out there evaluating a program for their child, what are the four most evidence-based criteria they should prioritize?
Based on everything we've looked at, prioritize these four things. One, implementation, fidelity over the philosophical label. Ask the hard questions about teacher certification, with the length of the work block, about the materials. Teacher-child interaction quality over the aesthetics of the environment. Watch for rich language, for emotional support, for scaffolding. Don't just be impressed by the nice wooden toys.
Great.
Check for coaching and professional development. Ask the director how they support their teachers' ongoing growth. A one-time training is never enough.
And four,
check for a real parent partnership. Does the program see you as a collaborator or just a customer? The best programs integrate the family deeply.
This has been an incredibly detailed breakdown. Let me try to synthesize the three biggest strategic insights. First, fidelity is everything. A high-fidelity AMI Montessori school will radically outperform a diluted commercial version of the same idea.
Absolutely. Second, environmental design is measurable and strategic. You can get a huge learning advantage just by doing simple things like reducing clutter and maximizing natural light. This isn't about making it look nice. It's about reducing cognitive load.
And finally, the single biggest lever is not the curriculum, it's interaction quality. All our investment should be focused on coaching and developing the adult in the room to be more intentional, responsive, and strategic.
And that leads right into our final provocative thought for today. When you look at the Perry Preschool results, that 7-to-12-to-1 return on investment, it becomes clear that policymakers should be treating strategic investments in evidence-based ECE as critical infrastructure spending.
Like roads and bridges.
Exactly. It's foundational for long-term social stability and economic growth. It should not be treated as discretionary social spending. The evidence is clear. This is a necessary economic foundation for a healthy society.
Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me. That's Y-U-D-A.me.